Welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is September 12th, 2002. This forum is 1 year later. Discussion of 9/11 and current politics. This being presented on 9/12.
It was difficult for him to hear people talking about vengeance because, first of all, he was digging to see if he could find his buddies, and but mainly he felt that most of the people he was working with were digging for peace and not for vengeance and war. But I also remembered reading some articles about people who were involved with the Oklahoma rescue operation or attempt at rescue and some other rescue operations that after the rescue, or after, and this one has gone on for so long, they often go into deep depression. And there's often a higher rate of suicide for people who've worked in that situation. And so what is it like for the people who've been through this to have a kind of national mourning? And how do we recognize this personal, very personal involvement in rescue? And then what about the individual families who've lost members or people who had friends who died? And how do we honor their personal grieving without being invasive, without usurping it as a national grieving? We had a national tragedy, and that's one kind of grieving. But it concerns me sometimes that, particularly with the way the media, I don't know if some of you have the same response I do, that when the media sticks a camera in somebody's face who's just lost their home or a family member, or and I saw some of it happening, although they seemed a little more respectful in this situation, and all of a sudden this personal grief becomes something that is on TV. And so how do we honor, and I don't have the answer to this, but how do we have a sense of national grieving for this tragedy and also honor and respect personal grieving? People have had very personal losses. So I'm more throwing out questions there because I don't have the answer, but it's a real concern to me about how we work at balancing that and honoring and respecting people's personal losses and personal journey through this.
Thanks, Margaret. Next is Janine Diller Murphy.
I'm not sure this is going to constitute an answer to what did we learn or what did I learn, although part of it will. I was pregnant, 7 months pregnant on 9/11, and it was about a day or two after 9/11 that I was in the Target parking lot with nesting gear, basically. I had like the mattress to the crib and bought the sheets and, you know, all those little hats and stuff you have to get. And I tried not to be too materialistic about it. But, but so I had all this stuff, and in the parking lot, I just felt ridiculous. And I guess since then, and partly in preparation for tonight, I kind of sorted the feeling out into two feelings. The first one was futility. Like, what kind of nest can I build that the rains of something like 9/11, you know, the walls, I couldn't make the walls strong enough or high enough to keep out the kind of forces that seemed to be at work in my world. And so it just felt futile to sit here with all this stuff, that trying to build a safe little home for my new baby in a world that was safe for reasons that went way beyond my control. So that was kind of the first feeling. And I think that the sort of heart behind that feeling makes sense. I think what I've come to see is that it's true that that's futile. And that's because the world is built for us to be radically connected to each other. And I guess I always thought of that as a great thing, but on 9/11 and at this moment in the Target parking lot, I guess I started to feel that there is a downside to that, that we're vulnerable. But there is an upside, which is that we're in community with everyone in the world, which is beautiful. So that was sort of the first feeling, is futility, and I guess I think that one makes sense. Second feeling, I still don't know if it makes sense, but it was a strong feeling of shame, of being pregnant. And it was as if I wanted to turn to the other people in the parking lot and say, you know, this happened before 9/11. That's obvious. It didn't happen overnight, so, you know. But there was this feeling like, are you insane? How can you think that it makes sense to bring a tiny little defenseless creature with pain receptors into this world where it looks now like pain is really likely? I don't know if you guys had this after 9/11, but I was scared. 9/11 itself was very scary, but I was scared that there could be and might still be a reaction that's even more pervasive in the States, that there would be some kind of biological or chemical or even nuclear attack, and maybe multiple such attacks. I thought if somebody was going to pull this kind of a move on 9/11, they probably had a follow-up act. And I started even thinking about having to go to the hospital to have my baby, where there could be other people having smallpox, and just wondering about all the kinds of scenarios, starting to think about having a home birth. But basically, I just started feeling like it didn't make any sense anymore to have a baby, because I couldn't see far enough down the road anymore to know that I was bringing this baby into a place that I want to live. And it was such a strong feeling that it felt like shame. And to this day, I'm perplexed about whether that was a rational feeling or not.
Thanks, Janine. And then we have Mike Scott.
Well, not as personal a reflection, but one that feels very powerful to me is that, and I want to read a quote, is about the violence of our economy, and that it's not surprising in a way that a part of the world would react in such a violent way, partly as a result, I think it's not hard to see, as a result of the violence of our economy on people and places. Elsewhere, John Cobb says, when you organize the global society primarily for the purpose of increasing production and consumption, you systematically destroy human and non-human community. I would think our economies would ideally, and not even ideally, sort of in a common sense sort of way, exist for the purpose of serving community, serving the well-being of community, human and non-human. And I think we have it the other way around, where our communities are seen as resources for the economy, and to the extent that economic growth has become an idol. And for those who don't want to buy into that, it can be seen as a particularly invasive way of organizing life and organizing the community. So in some ways I was like, we joined the rest of the world. So many other countries have experienced attacks, maybe not just like that, but perhaps related to terrorism, perhaps related to the type of violence that our economy can bring to a place, and that other creatures also experience that economy as a very violent one. So it seemed to me we, in a sense, joined now have a common experience that the rest of the world has already gone through to some extent.
I was up of the village overnight taking care of some personal business, spent the night in a hotel in Chelan, which had a TV, and you may have been here 4 days, but I've been here a year and a half, so watching TV is a rare event. And it was 9/11, so every single station, including all the cable stations, was completely dedicated to some kind of 9/11 programming last night. And then this morning I heard President Bush giving his speech to the United Nations. And one of the things that struck me was the total lack of asking the question, what have we learned from this? And maybe best summarized in President Bush's speech to the UN this morning, very strongly described the events of 9/11 in terms of black and white, and even without giving chapter and verse, quoted Gospel of John and said that the United States position as we prepare, basically what he told the UN is if they don't attack Iran, we will do it unilaterally. And part of his justification was to say, a light shines in the darkness and the darkness will not overcome it, and America is the light. And Iraq is the darkness. And so it was, and I know those of you who are living down lake have been hearing that all year, but it was still kind of shocking and unsettling to me. And so there's part of how that felt to me was the lack of relationality with the rest of the world. But I'm hoping that that there is a movement in this country of, while certainly grieving the event, that part of what we've learned is our relationship with the rest of the world and maybe some insights into how our economy affects other places. It's time to just open it up and continue our conversation together. So, any of the rest of you have reflections you'd like to share?
Just basically, I think we should have learned that we take violent acts upon other nations. They're going to upon us, and until it's changed, it's going to continue. And just because it happened in our soil once, it's surely going to happen again. And we kind of expect that it's not a problem we do in other countries. So, you know, I'd be worried too. I'm sure we'll see chemical or biological warfare very soon. It's going to happen.
I think that the opponents of attacking Iraq ought to be the ones that lead the charge. unfortunately, wars are fought by young people instead of the old jerks that seem to promote them. I'm sure if it took a vote in this country, they'd go rather overwhelmingly against such a thing.
Told the friends here that I was probably going to say something stupid, so I probably might as well do it. I have a real strong reaction to this as a whole line. The one thing in terms of what we've learned, because I really think we've learned nothing. I think that we are kind of in the position of Sarajevo, where the Christians and the Muslims live together, they have a wonderful Olympic, and then they shot each other. And when you look at the statement, what have we learned, you have two real questions there. One is, what is we? Mm-hmm. The other one, what does it mean by learned? And to me, learn means you have to have some objective. It says, I'm moving towards something, I need to learn ways of dealing with this. And we don't have an objective. We have slogans. We even have slogans, God Bless America, and Pray for America, which I want to erase and say, Pray for your enemies. In that case, is nationally. And nationally, we want to fight back. I mean, it's kind of like gang warfare, where you say, they dissed me, I'm going to go get them. And that way, we haven't learned, and we're relying on slogans, and so we seem to be drawing in, instead of, as you use the term relationship, but I think it's a wonderful term, is what we should be doing, is saying, how can we be in relationship with the rest of the world? And instead, we're looking inward, and more inward. And I find it really serious. So you've only had to spend it one day that I turn my TV off regularly. It really bothers me what we've learned. I'm not sure that we've learned on the national level. I mean, I'm glad to hear your talks, as you're more on the personal level, so what have we learned? But from the national level, I don't think we've learned anything. I think we've digressed.
We've become nicely paranoid. Every little thing that happens that generates great paranoia. I just cringe every time I hear about somebody left a bag in the airport, so they abandon the whole airport and they bring all the planes back and make everybody go through the detectors again. And it just, things like that just absolutely blow my mind. We certainly could learn to be somewhat more cautious, and that's one lesson that certainly slipped by. But somewhere we've got to get back to life again. Traveling it by air, or especially by air, and now it's turned into, in a lot of cases, almost like a nightmare. Some of the things that one has to, hoops you have to jump through. But yeah, I agree, we didn't learn very much.
We just really went into the attack mode. I mean, we've spent billions of dollars trying to track down Bin Laden, and now we want to go and attack Iran, and I think we're just setting ourselves up to be attacked.
Well, I think we did learn that we're vulnerable, and I think this was a shocking fact for us to learn. I was in Washington, D.C., just outside, visiting some friends on 9/11, and we were going to go down to the mall that day, and we just happened to have the television on, and it was about 9 in the morning, and we saw the whole incident, and it was just utter disbelief for me that this could be happening in this country. But we've learned we're vulnerable, but our reaction to it has been very pathological. Mm-hmm. As a nation, I think we're fast turning into a police state in many respects, although that may be a hyperbole, that I frequently talk in hyperboles because I think sometimes it has more effect than just saying, well, you know, because we're locking up a lot of people and depriving them of their civil rights. But that can happen, and it could be continue to extend to the point where there are lots of civil rights that we're going to be losing as a result of this. And we label paranoia, and I think we are over-paranoid in this sense. Life's got to go on. And there may be more attacks. But I also think that anybody who is foolish enough to attack this country, so sure, they can perhaps lease a dirty atomic bomb. But if we know who it is, our ability to respond, it's just horrendous in terms of our military capabilities. We could devastate the country in no time at all. So it would be utterly foolish for anybody to do that. Although Saddam Hussein is not a sane person, but still I think he has people around him who've got some sanity. So anyway, I think that there's a vast overreaction in this country to this incident, and a failure to really examine the root causes of it. Somebody said we haven't looked at why this was done, and I think it's done because we're a very egocentric nation, and we're getting more that way. Now we're telling the UN, if you don't do what we want you to do, we're going to go ahead and do it. I was really hoping that the whole body of the UN would just get up and walk out on that speech. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see that.
If you follow that line that we as a nation attack, it's Iraq, right? Not Iran.
Right.
Yeah, it's Iraq.
Whoever.
Yeah, but the thing is that if the United Nations is consistent with their charter, we will find ourselves in the position of being attacked by the United Nations because they will have to come to the defense of an innocent, victimized state. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just think our president has lost his marbles. I think he's feeling, but I think you said it very nice, Janine, about you came to the point where you said, I'm going to have this baby and I realize I can't build walls enough to protect it. We're vulnerable and I'm still going to have the baby. My parents had two more kids during the Second World War. You know, and my sisters were born in the 40s. They had this confidence that life's going to go on. And I think our history is that it will go on. Now, there's much more devastation possible with chemical and biological warfare, but I mean, a nuclear warfare, since you're maybe too young to remember that, but I can remember our building shelters so that we could have machine guns and protect our goods because our neighbors would kill us to get the goods if they, you know, I mean, this is the stupidest stuff that we've grown through, and yet we still haven't learned really too much. Because we are not looking at the root causes. I think the president wants to go on record as building the walls big enough to protect the United States, which is not possible.
Right.
We've got to learn to live. And to be in relationship, you have to be, one of you said, be vulnerable. I think you maybe said that too. And that's part of the risk of being alive. Mm-hmm. I'm vulnerable when I come up here. How much longer can I come up here and walk the trails before I'll have a heart attack? If I have a heart attack, by the time anybody brings me down, I'm going to be dead. I mean, there's no way that you can, I can, I'm not going to stop doing that.
But what a nice way to go.
Well, yeah. As long as my wife doesn't push me off the trail.
Well, yeah, you have to hope for that one.
Two thoughts from what you just said. One of them is, there was a certain peace that came to me when I just accepted that I was vulnerable. And that surprised me, actually. And somehow I got this image, I don't even know where this is from, of some woman in a third world country who was in a warlit land, but she was standing up straight, going about her business. And there was just this dignity about sort of accepting her environment and still doing what she did. So, just one thought. But I guess the other one's just a question, which is, you guys are older than me. I feel like we're in a different level of vulnerability than we've ever been in before. I don't know if you guys feel this way and if this is accurate, but I mean, it used to be that states controlled these weapons of mass destruction. I hate that term, sorry, I just used it. That they controlled nuclear weapons. But now people like Osama bin Laden, individuals can get their hands on or have the right connections to get some of these weapons. Nobody's sure how many or which kind. And I just find that scary because I guess I always thought of states as groups of people with checks and balances like any group has. But with Osama bin Laden, there seems to be far fewer of those kinds of checks and balances. And I guess, although I think a large percentage, and I'd probably say 99.5% of the world are people who would never do anything like Osama bin Laden would, there's still a percentage of people who will do that kind of thing. And that's what scares me, because now if that percentage of people can get connected to the right folks in the right way, then we have troubles that we couldn't have had before. Not that there weren't really scary ones like the Cuban Missile Crisis and the World Wars, which I didn't have to live through. But do you think that's accurate and we're only in a more risky place? I don't know if this is an okay way to set a discussion down.
One really distressing thing in all this, I guess, was to find out that the zillions of dollars we spent over the years to fund the FBI and the CIA and the National Security Agency and all these, there were all these jerks not even talking to each other. You know, they each kept their own little secrets. Well, we know this and you don't. And find out that all this complacency that we had about being protected because of our security system was a bunch of bunk.
Dale, you have your hand up.
200 miles out of Portland, the pilot came on and said, our company has ordered this plane back to Portland, so we're going to be heading back to Portland. 5 minutes later, he comes on and says, the Pentagon has ordered all planes to the ground as fast as possible. And that's all we do until we land. It is a tragedy that happened, and we don't need to say that God caused it to happen, but now we can say, how can God help us see this as a gift? And in what way is it a gift? One, I think the fear is a gift, because we've known a lot about how we have been controlling and manipulating and using the resources of the earth far more than our share, as Mike so ably has told us, that we have a low percentage of population and use, 25% of the resources of the earth, and those then on the earth who struggle to have enough look and see this ever-growing sum. And in many ways, I think we have been lulled to sleep, saying, well, it's the way it is. Hopefully our fear will drive us to say, hey, we've got a problem. What this was, I think, there have been many thousands of no's to the United States, and we couldn't hear them. Questions, challenges. Even at the UN a number of years ago, they wanted to pass some legislation against terrorism, but the way they defined it would have included what we were doing in Nicaragua. So we vetoed it. And how they must laugh as we come now and say, we've got to pass some rule against terrorism. Another way it's been a gift is that it has pricked the bubble of the messianic hope in our corporations. Our corporations were selling, have been growing at 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% a year, and we've just been reaping it in and cheering. And the rest, what it means is that those corporations are making ever more profits, and mainly by extending beyond our borders and absorbing the profits from around the world. And we were willing to pay then for those companies. This is where the messianic hope comes in. 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 times earnings, saying we believe that you're going to continue this fantastic expansion and ability to absorb the profits from around the world. A gift is that that bubble was broken, and that we, at least for a moment, are questioning some of our corporations. So the plunge of the stock market has been painful, but hopefully it helps us begin to question our corporations, and that they are the hope of our life. The whole issue of violence, someone has said it well, violence begets violence. And we can't use violence finally to win this war. If we think we can, we're going to lose. My hunch is there are millions around the world who are cheering Saddam Hussein. Finally, someone can say no to the United States. And so, although they may not agree with everything he does and his spirit, I would guess there's a lot of support for his ability to at least say no. So we could end up alone here, and that would be an interesting place for us. We, the leader of the world, with no followers. And then we're going to have to question, who are we, what do we stand for, and what do we need to change? And hopefully some of that becomes the gift of September 11th.
In the light of history, if Hitler had weapons of mass destruction, he would have used them. Looking back, could we have negotiated with him? And my question is, I'm not for war. Please don't misunderstand. But can we negotiate with these Pendolinos? Because I remember all too well what it was like before World War II. And we were criticized soundly for not going to the rescue of the people in Europe until we did, until our own Hawaii was hit. I don't know how that fits in. We study history in order to learn what not to look back, but to tell what we're going to do next.
Well, since September 11th, I've been shocked by Americans' lack of knowledge of history and America's role in the world. And a lot of the gripes that Osama bin Laden has with us that he mentioned in the videotapes are, you know, that we didn't get to see reflect America's history with the rest of the world. One of the things that he mentioned that we neglected to mention, or that was omitted quickly, was that UN sanctions on Iraq that have been in place ever since it invaded Kuwait, according to UNICEF and United Nations reports, are responsible for killing 5,000 children every month in that country. According to, this is, you know, UN numbers. That was one of the things Osama bin Laden listed as, you know, his reasons for attacking the United States. You know, that's almost two September 11ths every month of kids out under five. That information, you know, is not widely known in the United States. I don't understand why, really. I have ideas. Specifically about Saddam Hussein and our lack of knowledge of history, you know, he was our ally in the Iran-Iraq war, and there's people all over the issue on his use of chemical weapons in that war. Some people say, including a former ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Iraq, say that possibly, or it was very likely that Saddam Hussein did not use weapons against his own people, that it was Iran. That's just one person. I'm not sure what I believe on that, but one thing I know is that it happened in 1988. The United States continued diplomatic relations, continued supplying Iraq with intelligence and aid until it invaded Kuwait, you know, 2 years later. Our officials, you know, had no outcry against any use of chemical weapons in that war, and they would have known, you know. So if they knew that their ally, Saddam Hussein, did it, they didn't say anything at the time. In fact, just a couple months before Iraq invaded Kuwait, and the history, there's a group that meets at my church that has been working on this, and I have a couple close friends going to Iraq at the end of the month, actually, delivering medicines that are banned by the sanctions. The history of this is fascinating, and our role in this, and I really do think we're being controlled by the idol of economic growth in everything we do, and if we could see that as an enemy rather than a particular people. Anyway, a fascinating thing is that five U.S. senators met with Saddam Hussein personally a couple months before he invaded Kuwait, including Howard Metzenbaum, a Jewish Democrat from Ohio. We talk about, you know, Saddam Hussein as being an enemy of Israel, and yet you know, he had a meeting with a Jewish Democrat, and anyway, just I could go on and on, but there's a lot of information out there that you can pick up here and there in the New York Times, from people like Howard Zinn that, you know, state that possibly Iraq even had tacit approval from the United States to invade Iraq, which just sounds like a conspiracy theory. It's in a lot of people say that who I don't look upon as nuts. Anyway.
I think the real question is what Iraq used poison gas against the Kurds. And that's been well documented. Using it in actual warfare, this was a case of pretty much trying to eliminate some pesky people who really couldn't defend themselves. But they've certainly not yet tried to use it in anything that amounts to true warfare, I guess. But we still don't have any business declaring war on them until something does happen.
Yes.
A couple of things. One is the question about, you know, what have we learned, and one of the things was that we are vulnerable. And I think that's a valid statement that we have learned that we are vulnerable. I think our problem with it is that we've learned it and now we overreact to it. Sociologists have shown that we have very little, what we fear and what the real fears are going to related to each other. And now we've escalated this terrorism into way beyond its means. I mean, if you look at people in the United States killed by terrorism in the last year, including 911 in the last year, you compare that to death by drunk drivers on the highways, it's not even close. And yet we put far more money into one fear than we do the other. And so we have to be real careful about the overreaction that can occur in terms of recognizing this. The other half of that is we tend to generalize terrorism as though it's all the same. And we look at Ireland and say the terrorism goes on there or in Israel. But what they have is indigenous populations that are at war with each other. And they have lots of security systems in place because of that. We don't. We have an external, in a sense, enemy. And finally, when you say we need to go to war with Iraq, the things that I've read, and I don't know what's secret, but the things that I've read have shown very, very little linkage between Saddam Hussein and 911. A lot of the people came out actually were Saudis. From other countries, but there's very little link. Now he has, paid to have suicide bombers in Israel, and pays the families of his people. So he's clearly involved in it. But it's not a link to 911. So we seem to take everything and kind of ball it up together and want to come out with some one final answer to it, so to speak. And we have to be real careful of that. We look at it and say, again, what is our objective? What are we trying to do here? And what are the answers? And what are the real fears, and not the ones that are just emotional fears? And there's, would we rather be safe or would we rather feel safe? And we have to answer that question.
Well, and I think that the grieving it sometimes is played into that fear.
Oh yeah.
You know, where we have this whole national grieving that we've come back again a year later, and whether or not we're interrupting the grieving of the families who are going through this a year later. That isn't important, because I think in some ways part of that grieving is a response to that fear. How do you deal with it? Well, you have this kind of national grieving, but I also think it can play into the war.
And we tie nationalism into it. I saw an American flag made out of beer cans.
Well, and some of us who lived through the 60s had friends who ended up in jail because they misused the American flag. And now we see it everywhere. Yeah.
Well, I'm hearing a lot of terms of Iraqis, or it doesn't. If Jesus was here, wouldn't we be hearing about all our brothers? These are our brothers that we're talking about, brothers and sisters. And they're not Iraqis or Afghanistans or Americans. We're all children of God. And it's a separation. It's a duality thinking of us versus them. And when we see that we're all one, I think that many years ago, some children, some guy's children were born into this world. And instead of them being told that they were just totally loving beings and their whole purpose for being here is to love one another, they were told, well, God blesses us, but those people over there, they're evil. Mm-hmm. And they're going to hear that, and they're going to hear that, and they're going to hear that. And they want to honor God. They want to be children of God, so they're going to act upon that. And I don't know if anybody here in this room, if you've heard that over and over when you were growing up, you wouldn't see it that way. And I said in the last session, it doesn't have to do with money, or every time you hear about politics or government or money, I mean, look how wealthy Jesus was and how many dollars did he have in his pocket. His wealth was his love. And that's what we're here to do. And this is the whole reason we uphold him is Jesus' love and Jesus' word. And I don't see how it ties in with politics or government or money. We're just here to love. And when we know who we are, then that's how we base our choices. We don't have to think about our choices. That's just how we are. That's just how we be. We are loving beings. And we can just help people awaken to who they are. It's not about the money or the country. When we all awaken to who we are, that'll be heaven on earth.
We've had 2,000 years of trying to do that, and apparently we really failed.
Well, let's just be this moment. Let's begin now.
But it's been going on for 2,000 years, and it hasn't achieved that end.
Why focus on the past?
I'm saying that since the time of Christ, I think Christian people have been trying to do what you are saying in many different ways. Holden isn't the only place that believes that Jesus is love and we should learn to live as brothers and sisters. I mean, I think there are bad things the Christian community has done, but the Christian community today still stands, I think, heads and shoulders above any other kind of religion as to what it has accomplished in showing that love in hospitals and a lot of other ways. I am not satisfied to say if that's all we would do. We don't have enough time to just do that because there aren't enough of us really doing it. And so there are other things. We live in a very evil society. I mean, we have police, we have soldiers for different reasons. And we will always have those. We'll never, ever be in a state until heaven where we won't have to have somebody being in control. The question is how much control, like you said, so we don't get paranoid over it, and that we are able to, the reason I believe that we have to have police is so that good people can continue to do good things and not be violated. Not necessarily to continue to put down bad people, but it frees up our society. I maybe I'm missing what you're trying to say, but I've heard that a lot of times in my history. And as a pastor, I think that's what I preach Sunday after Sunday for 35 years, and in some people I saw a response, and some people I didn't. You know, and I'm not the only one. I think of all the Christian people that have gone out and tried to practice those things in the workforce and in their business, and even in politics. I think we have many. I think we're very fortunate when we have Christian people who are really committed to Christian people in politics, because I do think it makes a big difference in the way people go about doing those things that need to be done at those levels. So I think it's going on. It's just not, there aren't enough of us doing it, possibly, but it's not just, you know, we're not sitting around waiting for it to happen.
Maybe just to shift the frame of our discussion a little, let's pretend that those of us here gathered in this room are senators and congresspeople and the president's cabinet. You can choose which of those you want to be. But let's talk about what should our policies be and what should we do, and how can things change? How should things change so that this kind of tragedy doesn't happen anymore?
We should encourage the president to get on TV and say, we have an opportunity to not respond under the idea of an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. Or we should say we have an opportunity to learn from this so that we will put our resources into responding justly and compassionately and not with hate.
Would you recommend that he go over and have a one-on-one with Saddam Hussein to find out exactly what these issues are that need to be addressed? Not that we're kowtowing to another country, but that we, until we really understand what those people are needing, for instance, and if we could bring the resources of our nation to play upon feeding people or medicines and the like, you know. Was just recently, I'm just thinking about the people that went around, the musician and the father of Bill Gates toured the countries, didn't they?
You're talking about Bono and Paul?
Yeah,
Paul,
and it had to do with HIV and AIDS and stuff, I believe, yeah. And hunger as well. I mean, they made an attempt to try to listen. I mean, have we learned anything from what they have tried to gather? Are we responding at all? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess as part of the President's cabinet, I would recommend that we start out with a speech that is along those lines rather than vengeance, and then that we would begin a national dialogue on how specifically we would do that, and maybe that's one of the ways that we would seek to go and listen. And I think listening would be an important part of it. And I would think that offering real monetary aid and food aid and whatever it might be would potentially be part of that. And working with the UN to think about how our economic system and corporate power might be shifted some as well.
Is there anyone who hasn't spoken yet who'd like to?
I spoke, but I'd like to make a comment.
Well, just a thought. When I'm thinking about Saddam Hussein, I think about, 40 years ago, we had a guy down in Cuba that everybody thought was the evil empire. And it's interesting how America's reaction to Castro has changed over 40 years in terms of how we relate to that country now versus how we related to it, let's say, in 1960. In 1962. And the other thing that was a real insight to me, and I heard on television about a couple of months ago, was by a Mideast expert who talked about one of the things that he says a lot of Americans do not understand is the language of power in the Middle East. And that a lot of the stuff that we read about in the paper, and Bush is into this himself, is a lot of it is rhetoric. I mean, one of the biggest things that the Saddam Hussein can't do is he's not going to back down against the United States, no matter how strong we are, how powerful we are. If he backs down, he loses face among his Arab, other countries. And it's, I think, in Middle East politics, this idea of being able to save face and maintain some sort of public image about who you are, and maybe a lot of it's bluff, but I mean, I think sometimes we listen to the rhetoric and we've already assumed terrible things are going to happen, and sometimes, in my way of thinking, we have to put it in the category of rhetoric, and that it's not necessarily exactly the way either Bush or Saddam Hussein is talking. It's this bantering back and forth to show how tough, how strong, how powerful we are. And in this case, Saddam Hussein is standing up against the United States, and he's going to, you know, not back down. There's a lot of that that goes on.
Diane?
Well, I think along that line, I'll disagree with my respected colleague in the Senate.
I'm in the White House.
Okay, well, I'm in the Senate, and I want to restore a little balance between the executive branch and the... so I would like Bush to get off the television and stop speaking in rhetorical ways that are inflammatory, and remember that we're not supposed to go to war without the consent of the Congress, even though all kinds of war language was used. And take back or assume or step forward with the responsibility of the Congress along a number of issues. I would personally vote against war in Iraq if that's what's going to come to a head in the next month. But along addressing the Israeli-Palestinian issue, which is very related to all of this, it's like, where the heck is Congress? You know, this is all being developed in various aspects of the administrative branch, and it's certainly the ramifications of everything that is going on there, plus the growing discontent of this country with our policies as such, that I would like to see the Senate establish, you know, some kind of commission, committee, or whatever that would draw on diverse representation in order to work toward a more toward a policy that would be more of a solution than aggravating all of the agitation in the Muslim world against our policies. The other would have to do, I mean, there would just be a number of issues that right now I feel like we are out of balance, and everybody's so afraid that they will lose their, you know, they won't be reelected, that the statesmanship that I would like to believe could be possible in the Senate is missing. So if I were there, I would think back, I'd be from Montana. Jeanette Rankin was the first pacifist to go on the tour. But if I were in some branch of government that way, I think in the areas of national security, there's just a number of areas where somehow the executive branch is out of control. One of the gifts of our system is supposed to be that kind of check and balance. So, and I think related back to me, not as a senator, I think one of the biggest concerns for me is always I'm up here in this village, and everybody I know, I think, you know, is opposed to the war in Iraq. And then I go out of the village, and it's like it's a minority, perhaps.
I don't think so, Diane.
I was looking at the polls in Time magazine last night, and it's very close. Somehow the development of our own responsibility as a democracy to step forward and try to shape policy is really acute in times like this. And I personally wrestle with a sense of helplessness, which is one of the feelings with 9/11, and then a sense of urgent, you know, desire to try to prevent, you know, incredible escalating violence.
I see these two hands, but I just want to ask one more time if there's anyone else that's spoken.
Well, I just had a quick one. Yeah, my concern is that, like this gentleman said, Saddam won't be able to back down. Will Bush be able to back down? Mm-hmm. And my feeling is that he's trying to draw, like Diane alluded to it, trying to draw attention away from the congressional elections, you know, drawing attention to the people's attention to war rather than the economy, which, if that was focused on the economy again, if that was focused on by people, probably the Republicans would lose seats.
I did, while I was channel surfing last night, see one little advertisement commercial from the what's the controversial organization that always stands up for
ACLU?
Pardon?
ACLU.
Yeah, the ACLU had a little advertisement that said, remember the Bill of Rights, it might be slipping away. And I think that's part of, there is a domestic agenda underneath all this war talk, keeping our focus on that. Someone here out there? I'm going to go to him and then to you.
Okay.
One of the tough issues right now is the question whether Israel has decided to let go of their expansionist policies. And if they haven't, do we continue to support them in the way that we have? And that's been the major burr in the saddle. And when I heard a Christian station with a Jewish Christian talking about, but God promised them that land. So it's a lot of, I think, ambivalence around just what should we support and allow.
The gentleman here in the front row, did you have something to say?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
Well, as a member of Congress, my advice to the President would be to start working with the international community and stop dictating to the international community. During his tenure so far, he has wiped out about 50 to 60 years of diplomacy in developing treaties that, sure, they're not perfect, but he says, we're not going to go along with this. And so, in a sense, again, getting back to the idea that he is representing us as an ecocentric nation, which for any nation outside of the United States would be resulting in real irritation and anger, and we stand the possibility of losing our friends throughout the world with his policies as they're going now. So I, as a member of Congress, would advise him to
cool it.
Start working, cooperating with, pardon?
Cool it.
Cool it. Filibuster. And also I would advise Congress to get off their derriere and start doing what they're supposed to be doing as the other branch of the government, you know. Mm-hmm. As the checks and balances, they're not doing it. They're allowing them to do these things.
The elections in November.
Yeah. That's right.
I think all that's going
is it gets down to politics.
Echoing most of what was just said, I would bring up the problem with Israel, with the settlements in particular, are thorns in the sides of almost all their countries, and they need to do something to ease that situation. So I guess I, as an advisor to the president, I would advise that he start talking more softly and carrying the stick not only towards terrorism action, but towards what amount to terrorism in Israel, Israeli terrorism against Jewish population. I mean, I read both sides and say, well, you know, the Israel, the Arabs are blowing up the Jews and the Jews are blowing up the Arabs, and you can make arguments on both sides, but ultimately I think the Arab problem comes down to the settlements. So he needs to talk softly and talk to the Arabs as brothers and say, we have a problem here, brother. We need to settle it. And also talk to the Israelis on the same token. And, you know, put away the six shooters and start fucking.
Well, as a representative that's up for election November, I represent Lower Manhattan. And I haven't seen any action yet from you, Mr. President. I got a lot of people very upset. And I'd like to see something done around here. They're still very, very avengeful, and I got to get elected. And so I'm going to see something happening here pretty quick. And there's, I have a number of colleagues in the area who have got some of the same feelings, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're all going to be up for election in November. And we have a lot of money.
You know, just dump a lot of money into that hole in the ground.
We have a lot of money supporting we have a lot of other people, I think, that might feel the same way, Mr. Presser. We want to see something happen quickly.
Well, what about Afghanistan? That wasn't something.
That's not big enough. I didn't see a body yet.
We have about 5 minutes left. So.
Or when you were president, what I like to see is where we have a problem with our president. Go to them, get down on his knees, and have a bowl of water and a towel, and wash that person's feet. I can't think of anything more powerful than to humble themselves that much to someone else and say, "I honor you. You are a divine being." I just think that would be so powerful. And I question why you. And I just, my viewpoint kind of is a little different, but why? Why do we turn to our government when we see it seems like that's where most of the problems are? Why even set up that scenario when, to me, it's going to be the people that are, we're all people. But, It's going to be each person in their own heart doing it, and not turning to someone else to say, I don't have a problem for us. Ideally, yeah, we could elect the people, but I just see that it seems like that's given away that we'll have a God that has empowered all of us.
I like what you're saying. I find it really funny and ironic that President Bush is quoting scripture. He's a United Methodist, and so is President Cheney. And the United Methodist Church has come out against going to war with the Iraq. So I wish he would have some. I wish presidents had some spiritual directors or something like that, kind of like people here at Holden have. And maybe someone a little different than Billy Graham.
Over the past year, I've been skeptical about the liberal viewpoint that I've heard a lot up here about how we really need to take care of American Muslims, and you know that they're being mistreated, and I kind of couldn't believe that was true. And then again last night watching TV, there's this guy who's named Kennedy, I don't know his first name. he's a Presbyterian minister with a huge church
in
Coral Gable, Florida, and for many years has had a Sunday morning worship on TV. But anyway, he was being interviewed, and I couldn't believe I was convicted of the mistaken impressions I had, because he was really, it was just hate mongering against people of the Islamic faith, and how he kept trying to set up these comparisons about, well, Christians are taught to love each other and even to love our enemies, but Muslims are taught that they have to kill their enemies, so obviously Christianity is a superior religion, and kind of trying to hold that in my mind. But then, you know, then later in the speech, he's talking about how we have to attack Iraq, and it's like, wait a minute, you were just saying we're supposed to love our enemies and so on. How, just on the cultural level as well, maybe I could be the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare that we talked about. Trying to think through some of these assumptions we have about our enemies, and but also just being more and more educated about how the U.S. economic system affects people in different places in the world, and which we constantly take for granted. Without thinking about the impact it's having on other people who are doing all sorts of work to support our economic system. Was there anyone who wants to have the last word? Dale?
I put my hand up before you said that. Maybe it is the last word, and that is finally it comes back to me and my lifestyle and my priorities that support the systems that are destructive. And so I'm called to go to the cross and start with me.
Well, thank you all for coming, and feel free to hang out and talk to our panelists and each other, but this is the formal part of the program.